Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bond, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, February 13th, 2025. We have three cases on our calendar for today set for oral argument. This is the third case. This is A24-0829, State of Minnesota versus Amal Osman. This is being held via Zoom. This is being recorded and being broadcast. However, no other recordings other than the ones by this court are permitted. The recording for this one is via audio, and you will have access to that within the next day or two after this oral argument here today. As we proceed, counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent. And then after that, appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose to use that time. When you begin, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. There's also on the squares here, there's one square that indicates the time that you have. So please be mindful of that as well. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Howard Bass. I represent the appellant in this case, Amal Osman. Ms. Osman was convicted of order for protection and domestic abuse, no contact order violations in Ramsey County. In this appeal, she raises four issues. The first is whether the trial court improperly admitted a video purporting to depict the crimes with which she stood charged. The second is whether the evidence presented at her trial was legally sufficient to support her convictions. The third is whether the trial court improperly admitted evidence of other crimes as relationship evidence. And finally, whether the trial court provided const I'm sorry, whether trial counsel provided constitutionally ineffective assistance of counsel. Turning to the first issue, there was a video. It's Exhibit One in this case. It's 4.5 minutes long. It's undated, and it appears to be from the Element Gym where the protected person, Mr. Akeley, worked as a boxer. There was no objection to the introduction of this video, and its introduction constitutes, in our opinion, a plain error under Minnesota Rule of Evidence 9.01. The authentication rule of evidence essentially requires a party to demonstrate as a condition precedent to admission of an exhibit that it is what the proponent claims it to be.
But what is insufficient about SA testifying that it's a true and accurate version of what happened on the day in question? Why is that enough, to provide foundation for its admission?
I submit it would be enough, but if you look at the transcript, pages 128, I believe, and 129, SA did not testify to that. Let's see if I can pull it up here.
But that testimony occurs after, as an initial matter, when the party is trying to lay foundation. That's what the district court is focused on. That's what we're focused on, is whether or not there is sufficient foundation provided to allow the admission of Exhibit One.
Understood, Your Honor. And the testimony to which I'm referring occurred before the exhibit was admitted. Specifically, he was asked after July 5th, 2022, did Ms. Osman contact you? Yes. Do you remember where you were when she contacted you? He says there were a couple of times, different incidences, so I'd have to know the exact incident. And the prosecutor then says, did she have contact with you in person? Yeah. And where were you when you were contacted in person? That was the gym, I think. That I was at the gym. Do you remember the approximate date when that occurred? He says it was about two years. It was a while ago. So I'm not sure if we're, I'm not really exactly sure when it was, but the date should be on there referencing the video. The prosecutor then says, does July, on or about July 14th, 2022, sound approximately around the right date? That's at page 128 of volume one. And his response to that exceptionally leading suggestion was, yeah, that's the foundation.
Right, and that's a
Counsel.
credibility determination by the district court, and we defer to credibility determinations.
Understood, Your Honor, but there is more. If you look at the video itself, one, it is time stamped but not date stamped. Two, the content of the video contradicts SA's testimony.
But counsel, don't those factors go to weight, not admissibility?
Your Honor, we submit that they go to admissibility. It's a conditioned precedent, and because of the significant discrepancies between the testimony and what was depicted on the video, the absence of any verbal confrontation, the absence of any physical confrontation, the fact that the police weren't called until 2 weeks later when SA said they were called that very day, all of those factors go towards the conditioned precedent of establishing it is precisely what the proponent claims.
But you're using the testimony in the video after the admissibility goes to the foundation for in order to introduce the video in its first place. So I think Judge Bond is right that it goes to it doesn't go to admissibility, it goes to the weight. It sounds like you're talking the weight of the evidence after it has been admitted.
Well, Your Honor, just because a trial court admits an exhibit doesn't mean that after hearing further evidence, the trial court can reconsider its decision to admit the exhibit based upon a lack of authentication that's revealed by further testimony. And we believe that's exactly what occurred here.
And yet, you know, I'm troubled a little bit by the fact that evidentiary issues in particular need to be addressed in real time, right? Because if there had been an appropriate objection to lack of foundation, they could have brought in somebody that worked at Element Gym to talk about when the recording was from or whatever. I mean, and how can we find, I mean, why should we find clear error given what is in the record in terms of foundation and the lack of any timely objection?
The lack of any timely objection goes to our fourth issue, which is ineffective assistance of counsel. This is a case, particularly this exhibit, it's the cornerstone of the prosecution's case.
Well, and let me stop you there, counsel, because I think there are really two key issues with respect to that video that are relevant. The OFP prevented her from going to Element Gym. That's undisputed. She knew that. She was aware of that. And the OFP prevented her from having contact with AS. And so the video shows her going to the gym and shows her having contact with AS. Why does anything else beyond that even matter? Isn't that sufficient to show that the OFP has been violated in two ways?
No, because Ms. Osmond testified with great certainty, unlike SA, that video depicted events that occurred prior to the issuance of the
order. Right, and that goes to credibility. And we defer, we don't second guess the district court's credibility determinations that SA was more credible than appellant.
I understand that, Your Honor. However, we're going back to before the exhibit was admitted.
Right, and credibility is one of the factors that we look at in terms of foundation. That is a factor that the district court can consider is whether or not the parties are credible or not before determining whether or not the exhibit should be admitted.
Well, the district court in this case didn't have that opportunity because Ms. Osmond's trial attorney never objected, never sought to question the witness with respect to foundation, never objected to the leading question that established the foundation. So for all those reasons, the district court was deprived of its opportunity to assess credibility. The judge only had the prosecutor's version because defense counsel didn't contest it. And this is the key evidence in the case. And
why isn't that trial strategy to realize, okay, he's testifying to it. We're not going to fight this battle because we know we're not going to win. Why object to that testimony when it's a relatively straightforward foundational argument that is being laid?
Well, Your Honor, I was respectfully disagree to trial strategy based, in this case, upon we're not going to win. I think they could have won, and I think they could have kept it out. And I think that any reasonably competent attorney under these circumstances would have done all that they could to try to keep this from the jury. I had a professor in law school that said 90% of criminal cases are decided on what evidence is admitted and what evidence is excluded. And defense counsel did absolutely nothing to try to exclude this incredibly prejudicial evidence.
Counsel, can I, Can I take you to Exhibit 12, that unredacted transcript? If we were to agree that the admission of the unredacted transcript was error, that was plain, the first two prongs. Can you explain why that admission impacted your client's substantial rights? Really focus on the prong three of the plain error argument.
The prejudice? Well, because if you read that transcript, it references a domestic assault and an order for protection violation from dates different than those of the crimes charged in this case. And in fact, they don't even reference who the alleged victim is. It's not even, it's, you know, if you read the transcript, S.A., no, there's no reference to S.A. in there. And it may very well be somebody else. So the prejudice is, and if you go through that document, it talks about, let's see, page two, it says she's charged with one count of domestic assault. And then at page three, the court says, well, you're here for two separate files. The prosecutor says, in response to the judge's request judge's question about release conditions, he says that Ms. Osman scores an 18 based primarily on prior convictions. There are now multiple pending matters, all alleging very similar behavior. At page four, the prosecutor says the defendant continues to harass and assault the alleged victim in these matters. I mean, this is propensity evidence. The prejudice.
Isn't it significant on the prejudice component? I mean, isn't it significant that the state, as I read the transcript, when it published that transcript, did not refer to those damaging parts that you just quoted and didn't refer to them in closing argument? Aren't those relevant factors in the question of whether the admission, if erroneous, impacted substantial rights?
Your Honor, I would agree with you that that would exacerbate the prejudice, but I believe that the exhibit going back to the jury with all of these references to propensity evidence is substantially prejudicial under the clear error doctrine. And for that reason, plain error has been established by the admission of this document.
Counsel, I want to turn your attention to two other exhibits, Exhibit 2, which is the call log, and Exhibit 10, which is a screenshot of the text messages. Why are, I understand your argument in terms of Spiegel, but why is it error that is plain by allowing the admission of those when those were part of the complaint that was referenced? It doesn't seem like they're separate prior bad acts. It seems like those are actually directly related to this particular complaint and the charges filed.
Well, those
violating the OP and the Danko.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't believe those two were alleged. The allegation of the violation in this case was her going to Element Gym on July 14th, on or about July 14th, 2022, and thereby violating the order for protection and the Danko.
Well, does it matter? I'm looking at the complaint, and in the statement of probable cause, it not only references the going to the Element Gym on July 14th, but it references texting SA there, you know, on that day, and then it references these telephone calls on July 16th and August 2nd. So I guess I'm doubling down maybe on the last question, is that to the extent the call log references these additional charged offenses, why wouldn't they be admissible?
Your Honor, if they were charged as counts in the complaint rather than merely referenced in the probable cause section as evidence that there's a probability that the defendant has committed the offenses with which she stands charged, then they would be.
So is your argument that it's not sufficient that it's in the statement of probable cause of other actions that she took to violate the OFP and Danko?
Well, my argument would be that you cannot shoehorn in evidence that is otherwise inadmissible simply by referencing it in a probable cause portion of a complaint. That, as you're well aware, the complaint's not evidence. And what's referenced in a complaint should not immediately render whatever's referenced admissible as evidence in a trial.
What was the date included in the final charge to the jury? Wasn't it just on or about July 14th?
Correct. It did not involve the dates that were the alleged dates from exhibits 10 and 2, the call log and the text message.
Was one of the texts or call logs, was one of them on July 14th? I know that the statement of probable cause specifically highlights July 16th and August 2nd, but wasn't there testimony of either texts or calls being made on July 14th as well?
Your Honor, I don't remember that. I'm looking at Exhibit 2 and it's got three dates. Oh, I see I've run out of time, but none of them are July 14th.
I thought one of them was actually July 14th.
There's a August 2nd, July 16th, and a June 14th.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now turn to counsel for respondent. You will have 15 minutes for your argument. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. And with that, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Adam Hins. I'm an assistant St. Paul City attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. Appellant argues that the district court plainly erred in admitting certain evidence, that the evidence was insufficient to support verdicts of guilty, and that appellant received ineffective assistance of counsel at trial. Because these arguments fail on the merits, we respectfully ask the court to affirm the district court's evidentiary rulings and uphold the jury's guilty verdicts. Turning first to the admission of evidence, appellant contends that Exhibit 1, the video, was improperly admitted due to a lack of foundation. However, Rule 901 and the established case law around video evidence confirm that testimony from an observer that a video accurately portrays the event in question is sufficient for admissibility. Here, the protected party, SA, was both an observer and participant in the recorded events. He testified that the video depicts an interaction between himself and appellant that occurred on July 14, 2022. Appellant doesn't argue that SA is absent from the video, but instead disputes the date of the interaction. Such an argument, though, pertains to weight and credibility, not admissibility. Specifically, the lack of a date stamp and any evidence introduced after the admission of Exhibit 1 cannot logically or legally be considered for purposes of foundation. The Hager Court made out...
Counsel, sorry if I could interrupt. I mean, wouldn't you agree that this is pretty thin foundation? We don't have testimony from anyone from the gym. We've got SA testifying that he's uncertain about the date of the video. I mean, it strikes me as a little thin.
Your Honor, I would disagree. SA testified prior to the admission of the video that, it was established that both no contact orders in place, both the OFP and the Danko. It was established that there was multiple contacts between appellant and SA after the Danko was issued on July 5th. It was established that one of those contacts was in person at Element Gym, where the appellant was not allowed to go. And it was established that the in-person contact was on July 14th of 2022. But even if the court disregards that leading question about the specific date, it was still established through testimony that it occurred after July 5th when both orders were in place and when appellant had knowledge of both orders, which is sufficient to find a guilty verdict here because knowledge and the existence of the orders are what matters when it comes to the date. So I do believe there's sufficient foundation. I would note that the Hager Court laid out the procedure for foundation pretty explicitly, that any evidence that comes in after is to be used for weight and credibility, not that the district court can revisit its admissibility decision in the middle of trial. As such, the district court did not commit plain error in admitting Exhibit 1. Regarding the transcript Exhibit 12, appellant argues that it was inadmissible as Spriegel evidence. However, the state didn't introduce it as Spriegel evidence. It was introduced as substantive evidence to prove appellant's knowledge of the Danko.
Counsel,
well,
go ahead, Judge Rockman.
It seems to me that the unredacted nature of it, the fact that it was published to the jury in total, goes far beyond what was needed to establish that the Danko and OFP were in effect and that the appellant was aware of both orders. I'm struggling with, especially in the through the lens of the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, I'm really struggling how failing to object to Exhibit 12 and was a reasonable trial strategy.
And Your Honor, I would note that failing to object to one piece of evidence that the court may not agree with should not have been objected to, I don't think reaches an unconstitutional level of ineffective assistance of counsel. Counsel can commit an error, a single error, without it being unconstitutional or reaching the level of ineffective assistance. I would note as to the exhibit itself, I don't think this court has to reach the question of whether there was error because any error in the admission did not affect the appellant's substantial rights.
Counsel, can you just to clarify your answer to Judge Bjorkman on the ineffective assistance of counsel issue? Were you conceding that the failure to object to the unredacted Exhibit 12 was deficient performance, but you would argue that it doesn't entitle appellant to a new trial, or are you not conceding that it was deficient performance?
No, I'm sorry, I was unclear, Your Honor. I'm saying I don't think it matters whether that act, single act in and of itself, the court thinks was deficient because that one single act cannot reach unconstitutional levels of ineffective assistance to counsel.
Why,
I would argue it wasn't deficient because any error did not affect the appellant's substantial rights, and the transcript itself was admissible regardless of the redaction for substantive purposes.
I just want to clarify there, counsel, because it sounds like you're mixing standards because your argument there is, let me ask this question. Is your argument then that because it cannot satisfy, even if it's error that is plain, it cannot satisfy the third prong of affecting substantial rights and therefore under the plain error standard and therefore it cannot meet the first prong of the Strickland standard of reasonableness?
Just a second, Your Honor. Sorry. Your Honor, I would argue that, to find ineffective assistance counsel, the Strickland test, obviously the court does. I'm sorry, I'm kind of jumbling it up. But for a claim to succeed on ineffective assistance, both prongs have to be met. I don't think both prongs can be met in this single instance. And I don't believe that one single error, I would argue that one single error on the part of defense counsel does not fall below a reasonable objective standard of reasonableness. But furthermore, even if it did, I don't think that there's a probability that exists that the outcome would have been different but for that single error. And the second prong is stronger because there was no effect on appellant's substantial rights here. If the court looks to the factors that it's supposed to look to for substantial rights, the prosecutor did not address that part of the transcript in either the testimony that was brought in or in closing argument. The fact that these other charges exist were knowledgeable to the jury without the transcript because the Danko itself contained the court file number, the case type, warning of legal consequences for violations, and named SA as the protected party. So the jury would have been aware that there's another criminal case regardless. And that case involved some type of domestic abuse because the order is literally called a domestic abuse no contact order. And also, there was 63420 evidence in this case, which means at the end of the trial, the jury received an instruction that it could not consider evidence of other acts for the purposes of determining that appellant acted in conformity with a character, with her character in such a way, or to find the appellant guilty of the charged offense. So I think when the court considers all that with the factors, we can't meet the fact that there was any substantial rights were affected, and therefore even the second prong of the Strickland test can't be met if the court even finds the first prong is met. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you, counsel. Okay. I want to switch now, if I can, to and I asked opposing counsel this about Exhibit 2, the call log, and Exhibit 10, the screenshot of the text messages. They are referenced in the statement of probable cause, but they are not part of the charges. And in fact, in the closing arguments, the prosecutor focused on the incident on July 14th at Element Gym and really didn't talk very much, if at all, about any of the text messages or the screenshots, any of the additional communications. So if that's the case, was it error for the district court to allow those to be admitted in the first place?
No, Your Honor, I would argue there was no error there, especially plain error, because both of those exhibits were clearly admissible under 63420, which allows evidence of domestic conduct against by the defendant in a case involving domestic conduct.
Well, how is the reaching out by phone, while it might have violated the no contact order, how is it domestic conduct for purposes of 634.20?
Because 63420 explicitly defines domestic conduct to include violations of orders for protection and DENCOs. And so by violating the order, the appellant committed domestic conduct, an act of domestic conduct that was admissible under 63420. I would note in appellant's reply brief, they do argue that under Barnes-Slater that this evidence was not admissible. However, Barnes-Slater has not been good law since 2013, I believe. Barnes-Slater addressed an old version of the statute. The operative language in the old version was that what was admissible was similar conduct by the accused against the victim of domestic abuse. The legislature has since amended the statute to say that evidence of domestic conduct by the accused against the victim of domestic conduct. It then defines domestic conduct to include domestic abuse and violations of the various orders, among other things. So under the current version of the statute, these exhibits were admissible, plainly, under the plain language.
Was any argument made by the state in terms of the admissibility of Exhibit 2 or Exhibit 10 under Section 634.20 relationship evidence, as 634.20 relationship evidence?
I do know there was some discussion of 63420 evidence in the motions. I don't believe both of those exhibits were discussed in detail. However, I would note that case law is clear that the state does not need to give notice or make a motion to introduce 63420 evidence.
As compared to Spriegel, in which the state is required to.
Correct, Your Honor. So even if the court disagrees, that under a full analysis of 63420, that these would have been admitted had this court been the trial court, it cannot be said that there was plain error in admitting these, because they were on their face admissible under 63420. In addition to the ineffective assistance and the admission of certain exhibits, appellant does also argue that there's insufficient evidence to sustain the verdicts of guilty, specifically as to the issue of whether the contact actually occurred after the orders were in place. However, when this court views the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, the evidence was sufficient to sustain both convictions. Specifically, the surveillance video shows that appellant was engaging in contact with SA and was at Element Gym, where she was disallowed. SA testified that the interaction occurred on or about July 14, 2022, and also testified separately that it occurred after both orders were in place and appellant had knowledge of those orders. And if there were discrepancies, which the state disagrees with, the jury was entitled to resolve any of those discrepancies between the video and testimony in favor of the state's case. Case law is clear that jury is allowed to believe part of a single witness's testimony and disbelieve other parts of testimony. It doesn't have to take one witness as a full testimony and disbelieve a whole other witness. However, those discrepancies are also explained by the video itself, and so the state disagrees that there were discrepancies. The district court acted within its discretion in admitting evidence in the case. The evidence was sufficient to sustain the guilty verdicts, and trial counsel's decisions about objections and cross-examination were reasonable trial strategy and not subject to review. But even if the court, like I said, did find that one instance to be problematic, it still doesn't pass the second prong of the Strickland test. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm. If the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will turn back now to appellant's counsel. You will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal arguments, and we'll get the clock set for you. There we go. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. I really don't have anything to rebut. I'm willing to take the additional questions from the court, but at this time, I don't see anything that needs to be rebutted.
I have one question. What's your response to a respondent's argument that Barnes-Slater is no longer good law?
That is a great question. And I find myself straddling my ethical obligations of zealous advocacy with candor towards the tribunal. I understand Mr. Hinz's construction of the statute, and it is different than it was at Barnes-Slater. They changed two words, but it may have changed a lot in terms of the admissibility criteria, because instead of similar conduct, it's domestic conduct, and instead of domestic abuse, it's domestic conduct. So the statute essentially guarantees the admission of anything that falls within the enumerated types of domestic conduct. Now, what makes it difficult is courts, including this court, continued to cite Barnes-Slater. And continue to cite it mostly in non-precedential decisions for the proposition that the charged contact, the underlying conduct constitutes domestic abuse. That's no longer the statutory language, as Mr. Hinz has pointed out. It's probably a question that should be answered in a published opinion, but I guess that's my response.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to the candor to the court. We do appreciate that.
You're welcome, Your Honor. It's the oath I took.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
I don't see any further questions. So thank you very much to both counsel for your arguments and for your briefing. We do appreciate them. And as noted, we do appreciate your candor with the court and your responses to our questions. Very well done by both of you. We will be taking the opinion under advisement. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. With that is our final oral argument for today's calendar, and the court is now in recess. Thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.